Let's come back to order. Is the mic on? Okay. We have reached item number 4. We're a bit ahead of schedule still, and this is our HBA rules briefing with Randy Thurston of the Habitat Program. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Director, Deputy Director. I'm here this morning to give you the second of 6 briefings on the update to the hydraulic code rules. Last month, I updated you on 2 existing chapters, procedures and mitigation, procedures and penalties, which is now we're changing it to compliance. This month, I'm going to present 3 new chapters that we're adding to the rules, and these are mitigation requirements for hydraulic projects, authorized work times in freshwater, and freshwater habitats of special concern. So these are 3 brand new chapters, sections. I also wanted to mention that in your handouts, the proposed language for these 3 sections, are the complete text is provided to you in your handouts. So I just wanted to kind of recap why we're updating the rules. These rules haven't been updated since 1994, with the exception of the golden fish portion of the rules. A lot has changed since 1994. We've had 15 changes to the statute that aren't reflected in our current rules. We've had a lot of changes to science and construction best practices. So these are also not reflected in our rules. And it's really important that we update our rules to clarify the content. To me, the most important reason to update our rules is an applicant today can't pick up our rules and see what's required of them. So we really need to update these rules to make sure that we're transparent with our process and it's clear to the applicants what our requirements are. So the timeline, currently we're on schedule. We're still planning to bring you the official rule package of spring of next year. We have a draft environmental impact statement out for the rules and version 4 of the rules out currently for public comment. We sent them out for a 45-day public comment, but we've extended that to 75 days based on some feedback that we got. So the comment period is currently extended through December 13th. Last month, we also had 7 public meetings around the state, 1 in each region, and then 1 here in Olympia just for the mineral prospecting community. And we've met with the Forest and Fish Policy Group. So we're doing a lot of outreach. So far next month, we're meeting with tribes and also the fish enhancement groups. So the first section I want to talk about is the mitigation section. This is a definition of mitigation that's proposed in the new rules, and it means avoiding impacts and then minimizing impacts and then compensating for any remaining, and I'm going to say measurable, impacts. Currently in our rules, we have a definition of mitigation, but we don't have... We don't speak of mitigation in any other place in the rules but the definition. And mitigation is really the foundation on which natural resource agencies protect the resources that they're entrusted to protect. It's something that all natural resource agencies implement. Currently it's not clear how the department uses mitigation to protect fish life and what the requirements are around that. And so that is the main reason for adding this chapter. In addition, there's been a lot of changes to laws and policies around mitigation since 1994, and those are also not reflected in the current rules. Um, So I'm excited. I actually really like this chapter because I think it does a lot to really enhance, improve transparency and enhance the clarity. For one thing, it establishes a baseline for assessing impacts, which we've never done. So where is your starting place for assessing impacts? And so in this rule, our starting place is the existing condition of the habitat at the time the application is submitted. So it's very clear that we're not asking applicants to mitigate or compensate for impacts that occurred, past impacts that have occurred. We're only looking at new impacts that may occur in the future. So it explains the mitigation requirements. Again, if you're doing work on an existing structure, so you're doing repair and maintenance, you're doing major structural work, or you're replacing the structure, compensatory mitigation would only be required if there were new impacts that weren't associated with the original structure. So it's very clear. And I think it'll also help our biologists in terms of being consistent in how they apply mitigation requirements. It also clarifies when mitigation plans are required and what to include. If we don't require compensatory mitigation very often, our provisions in our rules around that are our technical provisions, so they're associated with a certain project type, will have design and construction technical provisions. Those are really avoidance and minimization measures. And most of the time, if an applicant can follow those measures, the ones that are appropriate for their project, and do their project at an appropriate time, most of the time we don't need to require compensatory mitigation. So while I don't have real hard numbers on this, I would say that less than 5% of the HPAs that we issue actually require compensatory mitigation. But when we do, we often have to have a mitigation plan for that. So leaving mitigation, going to the freshwater work windows. Currently in the rule, we have work windows for saltwater projects. We have work windows from mineral prospecting, but we do not have work windows established for freshwater, other freshwater work. What we have is online. We have published times when salmon are least likely to be spawning or their eggs incubating in the gravel, and that's the kind of our default, our starting times that we use. And the idea behind work windows is to really limit in-water work to times of the year when it's the least impacting on the fish that are present. So what we've done in the work windows chapter is we've tried to try to add some flexibility where we thought it was appropriate. So rather than just relying on a standard set of work windows, we've said, okay, that's our starting point. So those times when salmon are least likely to be spawning or eggs incubating, that's our starting point. And then we are going to look at the other life history of the fish life that are present, because a lot of times the timing windows in that are posted online cover a very broad geographic scale. And so we can look at the specific fish that are present at the site and maybe give some additional time. And then we also look at construction best practices. So there's a lot of best practices that applicants propose to minimize risk to fish life that can allow them us to be more flexible in the time that we allow them to work. So, and these are some examples of the best practices. So, in water work area isolation or erosion and sediment control are a couple of examples. In general, the regulated community has seemed real positive to this. They like to see this flexibility. They like to see us kind of stepping outside the box to work with them to give them more opportunities. Um, So the last section is freshwater habitats, a special concern. We currently have in the rules saltwater habitats a special concern, but we don't have one equivalent for freshwater. So this is an so we are creating one. So the freshwater habitats a special concern are they're spawning habitats for our priority fish species, and priority fish species are state and federal listed fish species and species of recreational and commercial or tribal importance. And most of the time they're both, both listed and important for recreational and commercial reasons. We also look at other habitat, specific habitat types. So we look at the habitat specific to fish, but then we also look at the habitat types that provide essential functions for a lot of fish life. And those would include the spawning and rearing, but they also include things like side channel habitat that's important for fish refuge during high flows, or deep pools or undercut banks that provide cover. Or in the case of deep pools, it also provides a refuge in the summertime when the water is warm. So we consider that also. And then there's certain ecosystem processes that are important to maintain freshwater habitats, a special concern. And we've called out two in the rule, and that is the delivery and transport of larch wood and sediment. And these are really the processes that form and maintain habitat. So, and those are also included in the freshwater habitats of special concern. So, what does it mean to be a freshwater habitats of special concern, and why do we put it in here? Although our rules say that we protect all fish life, we usually look at a subset of important fish species or habitat types to apply mitigation requirements, and those would include could include conditioning the permit for the type of work or the design or the location or and timing. So again, we're trying to add clarity around what we would likely require mitigation for by putting this section in for freshwater habitats a special concern. So that's my presentation on the three topics for today. December got four also new chapters. Common construction requirements. We've taken the construction requirements, things like erosion control and fish removal and relocation, and activities that apply to multiple project types, and we put them in one chapter. And so that's what's covered in common construction requirements. Artificial aquatic habitat structures is also a new chapter. You're probably more familiar with it being artificial reefs. And then we have two survey types that we require applicants to do on occasion. So we're putting the survey information in the rule. We just feel if it's something that we're going to require of an applicant, it should be in the rule. It should be clear what we're going to ask you to do and when we're going to ask you to do it. So I'll be covering that in December. And with that, I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you.
Very clear. Any questions, commissioners? Commissioner Kehoe.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. You mentioned you've had several outreach meetings. Maybe could you just kind of summarize or hit the highlights in terms of public input, mm-hmm. feedback, are people mm-hmm. up in arms, or are they okay with these proposed rules?
Yeah, mostly I was getting at the meetings was concern. They wanted clarity. What do these rules mean to me? When we were in Spokane and a lot of questions around small docks on lakes and rivers in the Spokane area and how these rules would apply to the construction of those docks. Euphrata and Yakima, a lot of questions around agricultural drainage and the ability to maintain those drainage channels. In Mill Creek, questions again around agricultural drainage were what I was hearing most. And then down in Vancouver, the ports, a lot of questions from the ports, especially around maintenance, terminals and marinas. And so not a lot of, I would say, I think most of the concern that I'm hearing is around water crossing structures, because we've added a new water crossing structure type to the rule, and we moved one that used to be in the rule to a new section called fish passage improvement structures. And I know that's kind of probably more than you want to know, but I think what I would like to do is probably dedicate one of these sessions to water crossing structures, because that's where I'm hearing the most concern, and I'm going to bring in a technical or more of a technical person to talk about why we're making the changes that we're making. But for the most part, people were polite, and they were concerned, and they want their concerns addressed. Heard some good feedback that we're definitely going to consider.
Thanks.
Director Anderson?
Thanks. Randy, I had two questions. One was prompted by this last one. What are you hearing from the small-scale miners?
Well, so for small-scale miners, we're hearing a variety of things. But as related to the new rules, the changes that we're planning to make to the new rules is we're putting we have a beach mineral prospecting process right now that they have to come in and get an individual HPA for those. And we've issued about 800 of them. We want to put those in the pamphlet, that language in the pamphlet, so they don't have to come in and get an individual HPA. And then we're making two changes to the timing window in their pamphlet. One is to the lower Wenatchee, which we're giving them more time based on information that we got from our fish program biologists. The other is in the Nooksack, where we're actually going from a 1 month's work window to submit application. So a narrower, a little more restrictive process there. They can't work there under the pamphlet. I heard a variety of things around the beach prospecting, some confusion about why the reference to ghost shrimp. So in the rule, we've proposed the line where ghost shrimp occur to be the line where you would need a pamphlet to work below, okay, on the beach. If you're working above the ghost shrimp line, then you wouldn't need anything from us. You don't need a permit at all. And so there was some question about why we're protecting ghost shrimp, and we had a hard time conveying the message that we're not protecting ghost shrimp. We're using that as a line to indicate where we want you to use the pamphlet. It's a biological line. It's usually fairly distinctive, and we're going to put a picture or a drawing or something in the pamphlet to make it clear. So that there's a lot of conversation around ghost shrimp. You know, there was just general comments about our science and the appropriateness of our science, and wanting to go back to the 94 work windows, and revisiting of former issues, I think, a lot of that. So.
And then my second question, which I think is coming in December, you know, I sense that most people, when we're talking about HPAs and fish life, and that the focus tends to be on salmon, mm-hmm. steelhead, you know, mm-hmm. and of course ghost shrimp.
right.
But we're, you know, on the beach piece, we're also sand lance, mm-hmm. some of those forage fish species are also of a concern that I don't think many people have a very good understanding of the life history characteristics of those.
Right.
The other, the piece with the nearshore areas that look like we're going to be a part of the presentation in December as it relates to groundfish, rockfish, mm-hmm. sling cod, the importance of those for juvenile fish to have places to go and mm-hmm. hide. And so I just want to make sure that we're making sure that that people are understanding the totality when we say fish life and mm-hmm. don't automatically go to a Chinook salmon and, you know, and that's the only thing they're worried about.
Right.
Or steelhead or whatever it might be.
So. Yeah, I agree. And that's another reason for the for having, I think, both the saltwater and freshwater habitats a special concern, because it includes, the freshwater includes things like Pacific lamprey and eulachon and margin sculpins and things that people don't really think about that don't get much press. Because
thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I just have to bring this up because it tickles me about the ghost shrimp as the demarcation line, because at least in Willapa Bay, the ghost shrimp have disappeared for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So they aren't as abundant as they were in the past. And you could get yourself into an enforcement issue if you have some debates over where the habitat of ghost shrimp properly is, given that shrimp abundance mm-hmm. goes up and down. It's just
okay. Well, thank you. That's good. That's good to know. We probably need to revisit that then.
And if you're digging in Willapa, if you're mining in Willapa, you're not going to necessarily run into a ghost shrimp anymore.
Okay.
Even in places where they used to be very abundant.
Uh-huh.
Just a temporary, there's theories about why, but it seems to be a natural fluctuation.
Yeah, I think the intent was that we didn't feel like we had to regulate them all the way up to the ordinary high water line, mm-hmm. and trying to find some place in between that made sense. So, but that's very good information, and we'll take that into consideration. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Director.
I had a schedule.
Okay, sure.
So the ghost shrimp, Pete. I had assumed that it was frozen because of more on the coastal beaches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've slogged around in the mud in Willapa Bay, and I haven't really seen areas where people might want to do mining in that kind of environment. So am I right that the ghost shrimp line is more in the razor clams, ghost shrimp above, and so you didn't want to go all the way up to the ordinary high water?
Yeah, and it's for the seashore conservation area, and is where the beach prospecting is allowed, and it's, you know, work with state parks on that legislation. So I would assume, I don't know if Willapa Bay is, I apologize, is in the seashore conservation area, but it really is for the more open coast.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense. Now, there are some sandy beaches in the inside of Willapa Bay, believe it or not. It's mostly muddy, but
have to show me where one of them is.
Right. There used to be more sandy beaches, and from what I've heard. So, but you bring up burring shrimp or ghost shrimp in Willapa, and it leads to a whole lot of other conversations.
I can imagine, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Good job.
Thank you very much.
We'll see you again. We'll be back.